through the 12th for the Board of Directors Candidate Forums. And call in with your questions.
On September 8th, the UV-746 tugboat is broadcasting live from 7 to 8 p.m. with a crew of authors, musicians, and performers.
That train, when it came in, it was going pretty fast.
Featuring the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Get your glass of water out of one of those springs.
New histories of old folk music.
And sprinkle a little lemon juice in it.
Train hopping, wobblies, and the Great Depression. Told from the utopia of cigarette trees where the cops have wooden legs. At 7 p.m., the tugboat on the Willamette lights up for a special one-time broadcast. Listen in at 90.7 KBOO and find out more at steamradiosyndicate.com.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Karen James. My guest tonight is Lisa Swart, who was last on Prison Pipeline in February of 2013. At that time, Lisa was recently released from prison, where she served 12 years for shooting and killing her abusive husband. Lisa is a survivor of domestic violence who is now working to change the laws for women who find themselves in an abusive situation. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been almost 2 years since you walked out the gates of Coffee Creek. Tell us what you've been doing for the last 2 years.
Well, I've been working really hard trying to get the laws changed, and that's entailed research. Why aren't the laws working? What's going wrong? And I've interviewed law enforcement and domestic violence advocates, DAs, all kinds of stakeholders in this hard work that a lot of people have been doing. And I've gotten a lot of answers. And it's really been helpful to understand sort of the mechanics. Aside from that, I've been talking to survivors. And what do you want? What would have helped you? So that I'm getting as broad of perspective as possible. But I've also gotten a lot of support from the community, and that's been really heartening. It's surprising and gratifying that there are so many people that want this to change.
So, you know, we have the Violence Against Women Act. We have the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act. There are a lot of laws out there to protect women in an abusive situation.
We do have quite a few laws, and we also have quite a few laws that are not being enforced. And that's one of the biggest issues. One of the reasons that these laws are not being properly enforced is that law enforcement officers themselves are often batterers. In fact, in the general population, it's about 1 in 10 families are currently experiencing domestic violence. In law enforcement officers' families, that figure is 25%, according to the Center for Disease Control, and 40%, according to the Police Women's Association and about 6 other studies. So you have this very high percentage of law enforcement officers that batter themselves. They are almost never held accountable for that, almost never. Less than 2% are ever prosecuted and don't go to jail, even if they do actually get prosecuted for it. So they're not that anxious to actually hold other batterers accountable. That's a huge problem. And there are 60% of the police officers that are good. So I want to make that clear too. You can't paint everyone with one brush, and we are really grateful for the good guys, but the bad guys make it hard for battered women. So that's one of the problems. One of the other problems is that women can get arrested for kidnapping their own children. And I sat there with the DA who said that never happens. Well, it does. And I've done prison time with women that have been arrested for kidnapping their children, which was actually fleeing a domestic violence situation. I currently I'm now working for Americans Overseas Domestic Violence Crisis Center. And a huge issue for a lot of these women is the Hague Convention and facing kidnapping charges if they leave with their children to another country. And there's something like 250,000 active cases. So for people to claim that never happens is very naive and uninformed.
So 1 in 10 women are being battered right now.
Right. And I actually want to clarify that it's not just women. Women are primarily the victims, but it happens in gay and lesbian relationships. Men are sometimes victims as well. So I generally tend to use women, but I want to make it clear that it's not only women. And in the fatalities, children are 19% of the domestic violence fatalities.
So why isn't this issue in the forefront? Why is domestic violence still kind of a hidden issue in our country?
Well, for one thing, it's so shame-based. It's really humiliating to admit that the person that you love does this to you. There are so many prevailing myths. For example, a lot of people think that in order to be a victim of domestic violence, you have to be poor or unemployed, when in fact, most victims, 60%, are working professionals. And so these myths really harm people. The biggest myth of all is, why didn't she just leave? Or she could have just left. And that's the one that nobody who knows anything about domestic violence would ever say that. But, you know, most of the women that are homeless with children, in fact, close to 90% are fleeing domestic violence situations. 90% of the homeless children that are with single mothers, that's the cause for homelessness. So, you know, sometimes people think, what's worse, putting up with some hitting or being homeless with my kids, which opens up a whole new risk factor. But also, leaving is when more than 80% of the fatalities occur. So you're often safer just staying. And people don't realize that. So that's one of the reasons that it's so shame-based and there's so much fear. Another thing is, people think that it's a woman's issue. And in this country, women's issues do not receive the attention that they need unless it's, you know, abortion. And then it's not for the women, it's for the unborn children that create the controversy. I think that because the newspapers don't put it in the front page, they don't make it a huge focus, they're not keeping a tally, people lose track.
So Lisa, you talked about a mother or a parent trying to leave an abusive situation, and so taking her children and leaving and being charged with kidnapping. What are you trying to do about that situation?
Well, the first thing I'm trying to do is get it so that family court judges do lethality studies or guardian ad litems so that they recognize that putting children with batterers ends up harming the children in 60% of the cases. Because right now there's this, once again, prevailing myth that they think that if the parents are divorced, then the children will be fine. But it's not. In fact, the opposite is true. The children end up getting hurt unless they have supervised visitation with the batterer. They think, oh, if they just batter the mother, they won't hurt the children. And that's a fallacy. So that's one of the issues. Another one is changing the legal definition of imminent danger. And in other states, they have a reasonable definition of this. And that is that it can be based on a past pattern of abuse so that you know when danger is imminent. You don't have to be actually shedding blood for danger to be imminent. And there are all kinds of analogies they use, but Old Yeller is kind of a good one because it's a beloved pet. It's a beloved family member. But once he starts foaming at the mouth and you see that he has rabies, do you wait until he has a child in his jaws before you shoot, or do you do it when you see that he's foaming at the mouth? Do you prevent that, or do you wait until somebody else is killed? And if somebody has already nearly killed a person and is threatening to do so in the future, imminent danger exists at all times. And since the police are not enforcing restraining orders, they shouldn't just expect women to be expendable.
What do you mean they're not enforcing restraining orders?
Well, they just don't. Most of the time they say they don't have the funding. And a really clear example of this is in Multnomah County, there were 120 batterers that were court ordered to turn over guns, to surrender guns. You're supposed to anyway if you have a domestic violence charge. But these guys were so particularly dangerous that they were ordered to turn them over. The police actually confiscated only 20 of that 120. And when asked why, they said, well, it's too dangerous to go and get these guns without a CERT team. And it's too expensive to use the CERT team. So therefore, they left 100 battered women with little children left to their own devices because they were too scared. And so it's very hypocritical, in my opinion, for them to then arrest a woman who has decided that she's afraid and protects herself.
So let's get back to this imminent danger.
Right.
So there's a pattern of abuse.
Right.
And at what point is this the first call to the police of a domestic violence situation? How would that work? What are you proposing?
Well, for example, in Kentucky, this is one of the places where they already have this law in the books. They are required to do actual investigations where they interview family members, neighbors, and everybody else. So if there has been genuine abuse in the past and threats have been made, for example, to kill someone and their children or their pet, they've said that danger is always imminent. So it's not something that somebody would say shoot their husband and then afterwards try and use as an excuse. It's pretty easy to tell whether there's been abuse or not in the past. Mm-hmm. So all that we would be doing would be expanding the definition of force.
So what is the definition currently in Oregon?
It's if danger is imminent, then you are legally justified to use deadly force. And there is no written definition of imminent, but what has been used in the past is two equal-sized men. That's kind of the standard that they use, which is completely outdated. And the state of Washington, for example, has said that that is completely unconstitutional because it deprives a woman who's 5'4" of her right to self-defense to expect her to somehow fend off a larger attacker who's, you know, 6'4" and weighs 100 pounds more than her without using a weapon. That's completely unconstitutional in the state of Washington. And that is exactly what Oregon requires right now. Because Measure 11, anytime you pick up a weapon, you're charged with the Measure 11 and there are no caveats. And so, you know, Measure 11, the DAs are just so in love with that law because it gives them all the power that the judges used to have. So they have hissy fits if you talk about changing it at all.
We tried to change it with House Bill 3194 last year, if everyone remembers. And it was the DAs, the district attorneys, who had that overturned. It was recommended to make very minor and sensible changes to Measure 11, our mandatory minimum sentencing law here in Oregon.
Right. And so that's why the sensible thing would be to alter that and to just change it and say self-defense should be allowed in the case of battering or, you know, and whether it's a woman or whether it's a man, I mean, it's not a sex dependent situation. But people who are more politically savvy than I am have said don't even try because the DAs will shoot it down, as happened the last time. So it's like, okay, we won't. We can work around it. And that's why we'll change the definition then of what constitutes imminent danger so that it fits the reality of a domestic violence victim. And here's something that I think people need to know. In the last century, 98 law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon have been killed in combat situations with, you know, a confrontation with somebody. 98 in the last century. In that same period of time, an estimated 3,000 women and children in the state of Oregon have been killed. So when you want to know who has reasonable fear, it's not the armed police officer with his Kevlar vest and a backup personnel. It's the defenseless woman and child. And that's where reasonable fear exists. And that's why the definition of reasonable fear and imminent danger should be from the people who are actually being killed at a rate of almost one a week. It's one every 10 days in the state of Oregon. And the fallacy that some people seem to think that it's going down is not true. In 2000, which is the year that I shot my husband, there were 37 domestic violence fatalities. In the year 2000, there were 55. So it's going up. It's not going down.
And if you just tuned in, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Lisa Swart. Lisa spent 12 years in prison for the shooting death of her abusive husband. Lisa now works tirelessly to raise awareness and to improve domestic violence laws. So where are you in the process, in this process of changing the definition of imminent danger?
Well, right now we're talking to legislators. We're talking to high government officials. We're trying to get support for the policy, and there actually is a lot of support. People have wives and daughters and sisters, and they're going, you know what? This makes sense. Now that I see it from that point of view, I think most people just don't really think about it that much. But when you break it down for them with numbers and figures and personal stories, they start to realize, well, you know, what would you do? And one of the things that when I speak to businessmen, I tell them, now let's say that you have a business partner and he assaulted you, choked you, and said he was going to kill you. Now, if you go to the police and tell them about your business partner doing this to you, and the police tell you, well, you need to walk away from your business, your home, your community, your church, your family, and don't take your children with you or you could get kidnapping charges, and you're going to have to live off of handouts. That's what we expect you to do. A businessman would tell the police to do their jobs. Yet, that is what society expects of domestic violence victims. They say, why don't you just leave? And it's like, no, why don't you arrest the man who's committing a crime? And the lethality issues are very different, say, than normal domestic violence. And that's something that people don't understand. In lethality issues, which are the men that kill their partners and families, there are some very clear commonalities. And there are studies that other states use. They're called SARA assessments or ODARA assessments. And they're over 77% accurate.
Talk a little bit more about these assessments. How do they show that someone can kill?
Well, for example, if a man has sexually assaulted his partner, if he has strangled his partner, if he's gotten away with it, for example, the police have been called and he's not been arrested, these are some really high predictors that he may go on to kill. And especially if he has a stressor like losing his job or the spouse saying she will leave. If he's been suicidal or threatened suicide in order to manipulate her to stay or just is depressed, if he's done five of those things, he's got a really high likelihood of killing her. So a lot of people think, oh, you know, this person hit me and I got away so you could get away. Well, there are different types of batterers. There are garden variety batterers and there are the family annihilators, and they look very different. And someone who has strangled their partner twice is more likely to kill them than a man who's beaten his wife 30 times. And that's what people need to know. Certain predictors and family annihilators often come from two family households where the dad was a professional and the mom was a stay-at-home mom. And so, yeah, you can't judge every domestic violence situation the same. I certainly am very invested in the lethality issues because that's what I was facing when my husband, I mean, he checked off for all of them. And I was even told when I called a hotline, you're a dead person walking, you know, you're a dead girl walking because, you know, if you leave, he will try and kill you. So stalking is another one. I need people to know that if somebody's stalking you, that's a lethality predictor.
Let's talk about some of these signs. You've mentioned a few: stalking, repeated abuse, and then if a batterer loses a job and has additional stress in his or her life, that can lead to heightened domestic violence here. What do we look for? What can someone do to help someone in a battered situation?
Well, drug and alcohol abuse do not cause domestic violence. I want to make that clear. But if drug and alcohol abuse are present, it's likely to make it a lot worse emotional abuse. If a man is controlling and demeaning and constantly putting you down, that's abuse. Threatening to kill pets, that's another sign. And are you asking for general or the lethality? Because they're different. Like a woman with a child from a different partner, that's a huge lethality issue. Emotional abuse, huge lethality issue. Drugs and alcohol, lethality issues. You know, most batterers are smart enough not to hit somebody so that the bruises show. You know, I mean, once in a while it happens. A friend who, if all of a sudden they can't make any of the parties because they have the flu and that type of thing, there's probably something else going on. If they seem really incapable of doing things that they used to be capable of, they're getting beaten down emotionally, probably physically as well, but those are signs. And the biggest thing that you can do is believe them if they tell you about it. Like, don't say, oh, he would never do that. He's the greatest guy on the earth, you know, because a lot of times batterers are that way to people. So don't disbelieve somebody when they tell you that their great guy husband is a batterer. That's probably, I think, the single most important thing that you can do. And then also, don't judge them for not leaving, because there are things that you may not understand. And one of them is, if he's threatened to kill her if she leaves, she's too afraid. And then if she's smart enough to know the statistics, or she's done any help seeking at all, and they say, well, 80% of people die after they leave, you're thinking, do I really want to risk that? It might be easier just to put up with some battering.
And that's what I hear the most. Why didn't she just leave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I hear it all the time too. And, you know, people have said that to me. Oh, you could have just left. And I want to go smack my head. Oh, why didn't I think of that? It's like, are you kidding me? Of course I thought of that. And if I could have, I would have, because nobody wants to be faced with possibly going to jail, or even the karma that you carry, justified or not, of killing someone. That wasn't even something that I wanted, you know. I have an uncle who is a law enforcement officer, and he told me 2 years before, oh, you're completely justified. If he comes after you again, shoot him, you know. Even knowing that, I still didn't want to do it. Even knowing that I was justified, it's like I didn't want to carry that karma. But finally, you come down to which karma is harder to carry. My children dying when I could have protected them, even if it meant me going to jail. Do I want to be too afraid to let them get killed? You know, no, that's a karmic debt that I think is worse.
Lisa, talk about the woman down at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility right now who are there serving Measure 11 for picking up a weapon, a bat, a gun, and killing or harming their abusive partner?
Well, for one thing, the women at Coffee Creek, there are reportedly, and this isn't a hard and true figure, but about 600 women there serving Measure 11 sentences, and the average Measure 11 sentence costs the state $600,000. So there's a lot of women there. I know of many who were strangled by a partner, and who then did exactly what you said, picked up a bat, a knife, a gun, and they were the one arrested. The guy who strangled them didn't do a day in jail. They got Measure 11 sentences for protecting themselves. I would say at least 3/4 of the women in Coffee Creek are victims of either sexual abuse or domestic violence. So you have a huge population down there of women who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, who were victims and who society did not protect but was very willing to punish.
Re-victimized by the criminal justice system.
Right, exactly. Another thing about prison that I think people really need to know is that domestic violence isn't just a women's issue. It affects teenage boys in particular. The teenage boys in prison who were there for homicide, manslaughter, aggravated assaults, the highest percentage of them are there for attacking the the man who was abusing their mother or siblings. And so you have all these boys in prison who were basically heroic. And so the women in Coffee Creek who protected themselves are being re-victimized, and so are a lot of the young boys. So I wanted to mention them as well.
So Lisa Swart, what else are you working on right now?
Well, so a few of the other components of trying to change our status. Number one, we'd like to use the ilearn.gov site, the way that right now they have all State of Oregon employees are required to take a test about child abuse. So we would like to have domestic violence awareness and education be a part of this. And we'd like to see judges, guardian ad litem, law enforcement, and DAs have an additional even 8 hours of testing, because they are the ones who are working directly in this field. But we want everybody to understand, so that we don't have people that think that choking someone is not domestic violence. We need for the whole society to understand what it is. So that's one component.
And that's exactly what happened to you, Lisa, that your husband choked you. What did law enforcement tell you?
That law enforcement told him, oh, you guys just need to go get some counseling. He had nearly killed me.
You did black out.
He threw me out of moving cars. I mean, he did all kinds of things. It was the closest thing to dying I've ever been. And in other states, for example, Michigan, that would be life in prison. In the state of Washington.
For the man.
Yes, yeah. For the man. For choking somebody and almost killing them. And in Oregon, it was a pat on the back, mm-hmm. which is insane. You know, Idaho, it's 15 years. Other states have a lot more awareness that strangulation is actually almost killing someone. Another thing is making terroristic threats a felony. Because for one thing, when you go to the police and you say he's threatening to kill you, they say there's nothing they can do. And in other states, they said, well, that's terroristic threatening, and that's 5 years in prison. And which is a really good way to remove the threat. And that's one of those lethality predictors. Saying you're going to kill someone, that's a predictor. Mm-hmm. Almost every time that someone's been killed, they've told people, he said he's going to kill me. Mm-hmm. So that would give law enforcement a tool for them to protect these victims and reduce the fatalities. So that's another component. We'd like to see batterer intervention available widely. I'd like it to be free, because I know that it's the children that suffer when the men are forced to pay for it. You know, one of the things that we kind of batted around was, well, let's make Wapato Jail a mandatory intensive 8 days, because in Europe they do 8-day batter intervention programs that have been really successful.
Wow.
So if somebody gets arrested for that, it won't necessarily cause them to lose their job, because if you get a felony, for example, my husband would have lost his job. Just like that. So it makes victims afraid to call, because you don't want them to lose their job, but what you want them to do is stop battering. Mm-hmm. And so this would be a really good measure that helps seeking measure for victims, wake up call for batterers. I think a lot of batterers don't want to be batterers. It's kind of a fallback behavior, and they don't, you know, it's not incumbent upon them to learn not to, because right now there aren't huge consequences. It would be an ideal solution, I think. Mm-hmm. And we've even talked about having an equity check, so that, say, for example, a batterer, you know, works, and if without that money, they're not going to make the rent. It's like, okay, we're going to cover this rent while he's in that battering program. And that way people aren't not calling when they need to. Studies show that for every dollar you spend on prevention, it saves $14 in incarceration. We've also talked about a hotline for batterers to call, which would work kind of along the lines of AA. When you call your sponsor and when you feel like taking a drink, you call someone. So when a batterer feels like he just wants to hit somebody, he could call this hotline. So that's another thing we've been kind of talking about. So we've been looking at solutions. You know, punishment is not nearly as effective as help. And that's one thing I learned being in prison. I saw all these people getting punished, and all it did was make them bitter and make them less able to function in society. And, you know, basically it's a big waste of money. And what would be a lot better is to help people early on.
Lisa Swart, you've been busy. Thank you so much. We will link all of Lisa's work and her contact information to our website if you want to help with this very important work, changing the laws, helping women, helping people who are in abusive situations. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being here.
Thank you very much. And also, I'd like to say thank you to both Louise Bichard, who, when I was walking out of prison, you know, with a felony, helped me navigate in this world and help connect me with the people, and the organization is Voices Set Free. And then also Paula Lucas and Americans Overseas Domestic Violence Crisis Center, who hired a felon. And I just want to say thank you.
And you have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/Prison Pipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Good night.
Get to know your candidates for the 2014 KBOO Board of Directors.
On-air candidate forums will take place Monday through Friday, September 8th through the 12th, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Morning Talk Radio.
Listen in to KBOO every weekday morning, September 8th through the 12th, for the Board of Directors candidate forums. And call in with your questions.
On September 8th, the UV-746 tugboat is broadcasting live from 7 to 8 p.m. with a crew of authors, musicians, and performers.
That train, when it came in, it was going pretty fast.
Featuring the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Get your glass of water out of one of those springs.
New histories of old folk music.
Sprinkle a little lemon juice in it.
Train hopping, wobblies, and the Great Depression. Told from the utopia of cigarette trees where the cops have wooden legs.